Welcome to Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here. And on the show today, we're going to talk about what you should grow to attract pollinators to your garden. And we have a couple of guests for you from Johnson's Nursery in Menominee Falls. One of them, Carrie Hennessy, horticulturist and landscape designer. Carrie, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Larry.
Great to have you with us, and great to have Ben French, who is Vice President of Propagation and Product Development. Ben, great to have you with us as well.
Great to be here, Larry.
As we talk with these two experts, I hope you'll join in during this pollinator week. What would you like to know about selecting native plants that attract pollinators? They can also help you with your tree, shrub, perennial questions as we move along today, certainly, and you can join in. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. Carrie, maybe first you could give us a little more information about your gardening background.
Thanks. Well, I got my degree in horticulture with an art minor from UW River Falls many years ago, and find that those two things, you know, I come at landscape design from plants first and foremost, and then my artistic background helps with the landscape design portion. So I'm always thinking about, you know, not only the aesthetics, but will that plant survive in your yard?
Perfect. Ben, what about you?
Well, I went to Stevens Point, and I was looking to become a lumberjack. So I went there learning how to chop down trees and manage forests. And during my tenure there, I figured out I liked growing trees even more than chopping them down. So I became a propagator and have been growing trees ever since.
Well, you kept that lumberjack beard, though. That's a great beard. you know, Johnson's Nursery has come up many times. It's been mentioned on the show in relation to various plants and so forth, where people could go to get them. Maybe, Carrie, give us a little history about Johnson's Nursery and where it's located. How it's been around, I think, over 60 years.
Yeah. The year I started, 16 years ago, was our 50th anniversary. So now we've been around 66 years. Third generation, family owned. So the president and owner is Chad Johnson. And I'm sure one of his kids will be our boss someday. But we... our focus is plants. For landscape installation, we don't really, our focus isn't patios, retaining walls. For us, like, we don't want a project unless, like, a lot of plants are going into it. And, you know, there's incidental stuff that'll pop up that have to be done besides plants, but that's our focus. We grow plants and we want to install them in people's yards.
And Ben, what's the range of plants that you sell?
So we sell trees, shrubs, and perennials, from the smallest size being about a plug, which is like a 1-inch wide, 2-inch deep plug, all the way up to very large, bald and burlap, field harvested trees. I think the biggest tree we ever moved might have been something like a 10-inch tree.
That's like 10-inch caliper, the diameter of the trunk?
Yeah, so that's a very large plant.
And you must have moved them. That reminds me, the services you offer is fairly broad range.
So we sell to other contractors and municipalities. So we have our wholesale department, and we also have retail sales where people can come in and they can shop at their leisure and take stuff home. We also offer delivery services. And like, say you pick out a crabapple tree and you want to have it installed, our retail staff will arrange that for you. And then I work in our landscape design and install department. So my job will vary from somebody just wanting like what we call a green screen. They want to screen their neighbors. You know, half of our work is probably because people don't want to see their neighbors. And or it might be more complicated that, you know, they want to completely redo the existing landscape around their house. We don't do a lot of new construction. A lot of what I do is mostly like renovation based. I also work with a lot of park systems, doing tree installations and beautifying parks areas and working with different friend groups.
So lots involved there with the two of you and with the nursery in general. And here we are, Pollinator Week. And maybe talk a little bit more from your perspective about why we need more pollinators in our gardens.
Do you want to take that one or do you want me to?
I'll take that one. Yeah, so why do we need pollinators? They're very important to all of us because they provide a huge service in pollinating almost all the fruits and vegetables that we eat. And in the news recently, you hear left and right that there's declines in pollinator populations. And I think that as a homeowner, you can take some of that responsibility onto yourself and renovate your yard, including plants that support them, so we can have better populations in and around where we live.
And I know you sell a lot of native plants. Carrie, has that ramped up over the last few years?
Oh, for sure. I remember when I was in college, native plants were not really the focus. If anything, like when we were learning about something, it would be kind of being a side, oh, by the way, it's Wisconsin native. And then when I graduated, that's when the whole native, you know, trend exploded. And that is a trend that I don't think will ever go away, nor should it. Because, you know, native plants, typically the native plants are what support our native insects, what support our native wildlife. And it doesn't mean that non-natives can't do that, but they're just not as effective at it. Yeah, go ahead.
You wonder why native plants are so attractive to pollinators. Do we know?
They evolve together.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes a lot of good sense. And I've got a lot of questions about best plants for various insects. But Nate in Madison has a question. Let's just check in with Nate. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi. So I have a vegetable garden. They're all in raised beds, and that's gated in. And I'd like to do a native plant border around it to increase pollination rates and attract pollinators. Is there a certain distance away from, like, my vegetables that increases those, you know, pollination rates?
Yeah. I would say, you know, the closer the better. And sometimes having certain plants around your vegetable garden might deter the rabbits from getting in as well. You know, things in the mint family like bee balm help repel the rabbits from eating your vegetables. I don't know. I would just say as close as possible.
Yeah, I would say close as possible or even mixed with your garden. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you can put some perennials in your garden. You can plant your vegetables around those. I guess one piece of advice I would offer is try to select a fairly short set of native plants just so you have that good airflow in your garden still if it's not too big.
Yeah, many native perennials tend to be very tall, especially if we're talking about a vegetable garden area. I'm guessing that it's in pretty full sun. So a lot of our sun natives do like to get tall. So you just want to make sure you're aware of that mature height. Like prairie smoke is a great one as a border plant because it stays short. And it's one of the first plants that blooms for the bumblebees to start pollinating and getting their nectar, the things that they need. And it's also just a beautiful ornamental plant. I use it a lot.
Yeah, they're pretty. And you can, I mean, there's other things you could add that maybe, I don't know if zinnias might be, I know zinnias are really attracting, are good at attracting pollinators. And it's something you could also just slot in there from one year to the next.
Yeah, I do that in my own vegetable garden. I'll seed zinnias, sunflowers around, you know, my tomato plants, things like that. And then I have a small yard, so I have few raised beds, and then the rest of my garden is mostly native plants, flowering things for the bees and the butterflies.
Yeah, I think marigolds are also really good attractors for pollinators. At least the ones I have in my yard are. So there you go, Nate. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. You can join in too at 800-642-1234. Email to talk at wpr.org. What are some of the best plants to attract butterflies?
I'll take this one.
Okay.
So attracting butterflies, there's two things that you need. You need the host plant for the caterpillars, which is usually very specific And then you need the flowers that are for nectaring adults, which is usually pretty broad. Most, you know, flowering natives will attract a lot of different butterflies, but like, you know, we all know milkweed is very specific for the monarch caterpillar. Also things in like the carrot and parsley family, those are going to be for your swallowtail butterflies. So if you have the room and that you can have the plants that are going to support both stages of life, that's ideal. But you know, if you don't have the room and you just want the aesthetics, you know, if it's flowering, like things like coneflower, Rudbeckia, Anna's hyssop is fantastic. The Agastakis. I love that one for attracting butterflies. I call them my beacon plants. So sometimes if you have the things that are like, just like catnip to butterflies, that'll bring them in the yard and then they find the other good natives that they need to support their full life cycle.
You mentioned coneflowers, and I think Vivian in Green Bay has something that relates to coneflowers. Let's go there. Hi, Vivian.
Hello. I have a small lot planted for pollinators and wildlife in general, but the brown-eyed Susans, black-eyed Susans, they seem to push out my coneflower, and I've witnessed this over the last 3 or 4 years. And I'm not convinced that brown-eyed Susans are better for pollinators than the coneflowers, so I don't want my coneflowers pushed out.
All right. Well, so what do we got going there, Carrie?
Actually, I'm going to let Ben take this one.
All right, Ben.
Yeah, so echinaceas, coneflowers, we like to call those temperennials here at Johnson's. They typically occupy a space in the garden for like 3 to 5 years before they have to start reseeding if they're going to maintain themselves in your space. So if there's a lot of competition from other plants like brown-eyed Susan or black-eyed Susan, the seedlings are probably not going to compete and they're probably going to slowly die out. So you'll have to get in there and do some old-fashioned gardening and start ripping out some of your excess brown-eyed and black-eyed Susans. Maybe buy a few more echinaceas to put back in there. But if you clear the space, the echinaceas should like reseed back if you have good seed production already.
Ah, there you go, Vivian. Thanks so much. I haven't had any trouble with my coneflowers. Man, they can seem to be out-competing a lot of things in my flower garden, to be perfectly honest. Oh, Vivian, thanks again. Jerry in Caledonia, Minnesota, we'll go to you. Hi, Jerry.
Hey, good morning, Larry and friends. I have a Black Hills spruce tree that I planted 2 years ago, doing very well. It's got about 6 or 8 inches of growth this year. Should I be pruning it? And what time of the year would you suggest pruning?
Okay. Ben?
Is it getting too big for the space?
I beg your pardon?
Is it getting too big for the space, or do you just feel like you should be pruning it?
Well, I don't want it to get too big.
Okay. Well, the good news is Black Hill spruce is one of the slower growing ones. They typically don't push out quite as much new growth as, like, say, a Colorado spruce or a Norway spruce would. This is the time of year after they've finished doing what we call candling. They're pushing out that new growth. You can shear that off if you want. It just requires a lot of, you know, you're going to have to do it every year. And also you want to be careful that you don't shear it too tight and suddenly you lose that natural kind of loose form. So my MO is pick a tree that isn't going to get too big for a space so you don't have to do that, and just like have a hands-off approach. Does that answer your question?
Does that help, Jerry?
Well, sort of. It's getting the top is probably the biggest growth. There's maybe 8 to 10 inches of growth. And I just kind of want to keep control of it, but I don't want to hurt it either because it's doing so well.
If you whack the top off, that's not going to make a good look. Is it, Carrie?
It depends how you do it. It sounds like it's having a growth spurt. And a lot of times trees, they might shoot up on the top and then the sides aren't filling out. So they tend to like shoot up and then shoot out the following year. 8 to 10 inches, that's quite the growth spurt.
Yeah.
You just want to be careful that you're not taking out that central leader and ruining that pyramidal form of it.
All right. Jerry, good luck with that. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or you can email us to talk@WPR.org. Talking today with a couple of representatives from Johnson's Nursery in Menominee Falls, Ben French and Carrie Hennessy. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you with us for this edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here with my two guests, Carrie Hennessy, horticulturist and landscape designer, and Ben French, VP of Propagation and Product Development, of course, both with Johnson's Nursery in Menominee Falls. Again, you can join in at 800-642-1234, email to talk@WPR.org. Joan emailed to ask what pathogen or insect causes branches on many of her ornamental shrubs to produce tiny, unnatural leaves. Other branches may be okay. The tiny leaves are often clustered abnormally. Is this witch's broom, and are the shrubs fatally ill?
Sounds like...
Yeah, that's a really good question, and the phenomenon that she's seeing is caused by a myriad of different problems. So just depending on the species you're looking at, a different insect, fungus, or virus could be causing that kind of issue. So for example, like ninebarks, you can have powdery mildew that causes that, where the branch will be stunted, covered in white, kind of fuzzy looking stuff, and it'll look really bad on your plant, especially if there's a lot of it. Versus something like a Freeman maple, like Autumn Blaze, that one gets a mite infestation just around this time of year that can stunt the new growth and cause it to kind of bunch up on the top. And then there's other things in different parts of the state, like mistletoe, that can land on your spruce trees or your pine trees and cause a significant witch's brooming as well.
The other thing that recently we're getting a lot of calls about is herbicide damage, that especially because we just had this little heat wave that came through, that if like lawn services are still doing weed and feeds, because typically like before 4th of July is when people are doing that, because it was so hot, the herbicide might be volatilizing the 2,4-D, which is a broadleaf herbicide, and it could be causing that witch's brooming, that weird effect on the tips of the shrubs. We see that a lot right now.
Yeah, herbicides were kind of the first thing that came into my mind as well. So those are some of the things to consider, Joan. Sometimes if you have some good photos, you can send them into the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic, and Brian Huddleston can take a look at the UW Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic. And if he thinks it's an insect issue or something else, he'll send it off to the insect diagnostic lab. But he would be able to recognize if it was whatever I think might be the problem there. Karen in Madison, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Karen.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I redid some landscaping a number of years ago and put in a small blue spruce, globe blue spruce standard. And if it had grown for 2 years and stopped, I would have been really happy. but I'm thinking now, just the width of it, I need to do a little bit of pruning, and I'm wondering when I should do that and how I should do that so I don't damage the tree, which the robins love making their nests in.
The best time now is a great time to do it, because they pushed out the new growth and it's starting to do what we call hardening off. So it's easiest to cut off that new growth when it's still fresh. You can't, with evergreens, it's difficult to try to make them smaller than what they currently are without like looking at stumpy pruning cuts. But if you can maintain the shape, not let it get any wider, you're just going to do that by cutting off that new growth every year.
You're just going to have to keep at it every year, Karen. There you go. Thank you for calling. Well, let's see. Let's go to Kathy in Stevens Point. Hi, Kathy.
Hi there. I was wondering about the big box stores, and I hear that people shouldn't buy plants there because of the nicotinoids that are used in growing, and I was wondering if that's still the case or not.
You take this one. You're the grower.
Yeah, so a lot of press recently about neonicotinoids and their possible effects on damaging these pollinator populations. A lot of people are rightly concerned, and I would say if you are buying plants, you should try to buy local. Odds are the person at a local business is going to know where their plants are actually from, and they're going to be able to answer those kinds of questions accurately. So like for us, we don't use any neonicotinoids on any of our plants except for a couple really bad pests on oaks after we transplant them. And it's like a very specific use. But on all of our perennials, we don't use any. I would just try to buy from a person who knows the grower, because the grower is actually going to know the answer to what chemicals were used on what plants and when. They're really the only ones that are going to be able to tell you that. Some growers have switched to signage where it says this was grown without neonicotinoids or this was grown with neonicotinoids. And that's somewhat helpful information too.
Yeah. So the local nurseries, and there are a lot of local nurseries around the state. I like to patronize them, and I think it's a kind of a good thing to do because they're local, just as you say, Ben. Appreciate it. Kathy, thank you for calling. Nick in Edgerton, we'll go to you. Hi, Nick.
Hey, Larry, quick question for my cousin there. Giant sunflowers. Hey, cousin Carrie.
Hi.
Giant sunflowers. What would be the, without knowing the specific variety, what would be a rough estimate on maturity date for those? Is it too late to be planting those? Second question, I did keep back from seeds from previous years, and they seem to be germinating. Are those plants going to be just kind of replicas of the plant they came from? And then how deep a soil? Am I kind of hurting those things by putting them in a raised bed where I only really have about maybe 10 inches of soil at very most?
For sunflower seeds, I think that's enough soil. I do that in my raised beds too, where I have like concrete on the patio underneath. It's just when you get the really tall ones, if they can't root down far enough, we get big winds, they might fall over towards the end of the season. I don't think it's too late. You know, we've still got a lot of season left, and we've been getting, you know, extended falls. So you could still plant your sunflower seeds. I mean, the birds are doing it every day when they're, you know, going to people's feeders. They're still dispersing the seeds and they're germinating. What was your other question? I forgot.
One was about seeds that that he had from last year, I think. Oh, was that right, Nick?
Yep. Yep. Correct, Larry.
They were from the sunflowers that you grew last year?
Or even a couple years ago.
Yeah, so the thing about seeds is that, like when you buy the packets of seeds from the garden centers, those are a specific variety usually. And then once you start growing from seeds, there might be a little bit, there's going to be some variability to, you know, the color, the size of the sunflower might be different than its parent that you saved from last year. But variety is the spice of life, right?
There you go. Nick, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call.
Hey, to your parents, Nick.
All right. You can join in, too. Join Nick from Edgerton and give a call at 800-642-1234. Or you can email us to talk@wpr.org. Besides plants, by the way, we're talking about pollinators a little bit here. What other things can you do in the garden besides plants to attract pollinators to your garden?
Are you talking about like feeders?
Well, I'm like, wondering, what have you got? have you got some
water? Yeah. Having a source of water is really important. Keeping a, you know, bird baths. Pollinators will be attracted to those, but I'm sure people have seen like the, you know, photos online of like saving your wine corks and floating them in your bird bath so they don't drown. I fish a lot of bumblebees out of my feeder. or out of my bird bath. So you want to have nice, shallow, consistent, clean water. You can also get what's called bee cups. And I found some like pretty ceramic, shallow flower cups that I put in some of my potted plants that I fill up every morning when I water, so the bees have a safe place to drink. And the butterflies will do that too. The butterflies tend to, they don't usually go to fresh open water. They like to go to like a muddy puddle or like a sandy area. So you can fill up a bird bath with sand and keep it consistently moist for water. And then they'll do what's called puddling there. It's especially important for male butterflies. They need to get certain nutrients from all the salt and minerals for reproductive reasons.
Oh, I didn't realize that. So you could, and you could probably have, would there be a way to make that bird bath half sand, you know, put sand on half of it or something and then leave the other half a little more open? Probably could do that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't know why not. Mary in Danbury, we'll go to you. Hi, Mary.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I'm on a lake in Burnett County, way up north, and I had a huge oak tree. And 2 years ago, we had a straight line wind come straight at my cabin, and it toppled that tree. Thankfully, it didn't hit the house, but it had a lot of woodpecker holes on it. And now I have two other oaks in front of the cabin. They're about, I'd say, 12 to 15 inches diameter. And I love them because they give me some shade as I'm facing south. But they also have a lot of woodpecker holes, and my son said they're not stable. I better get rid of them. So, okay, so if I have them removed, I don't want to plant pines in front of a house because I have a big sun porch, and it will, you know, obscure the view of the lake. But what can I plant there? I mean, I'd like to have trees again, but...
You might want to check with is there a local person who is an expert on a tree expert that could come out and take a look at the trees and make sure that they are in fact, I mean,
because woodpeckers are gonna they go after healthy trees, they go after unhealthy trees. So it's not necessarily indicative that there's something wrong with the trees.
Right. What the woodpeckers do is they go after bugs. So if your healthy tree has a single bug right below the bark, it's going to punch holes in it looking for that bug. So I would contact a tree care professional, just as you said, Larry, just to make sure that those trees are indeed healthy or not.
But if they're not, what would be a substitute? I'd put in another oak myself, but that's a low, kind of a slow grower. What do you suggest? And this is, Mary's wants to be able to still see the lake from her home.
Elm trees, there are disease resistant elm trees now, and elm trees are typically very fast growing. And so you can limb up those lower branches so you can still see the lake and get shade. Plus, they do support a lot of native birds and insects. The other thing I'm thinking is maybe hackberry.
Hackberry would be good, and maybe something like a sugar maple, too.
Mm. Sugar maples are great.
Yeah, that could work, too. So there are some ideas, but I would first see a tree care professional and have them, because, trees like that, they don't grow on trees. Let's just double up on some sort of metaphor. Or there. If you got trees that size, you want to keep them if you can. Mike in Dunn, or in Dane, I'm sorry. Mike, thank you for calling.
Thanks for taking my call, Larry.
Mm-hmm.
So I have a Montmorency tart cherry tree that I've had for about 4 or 5 years. And this year it is absolutely loaded. And I'm thinking that's probably due to all the rain that we've had. But so I've been out picking cherries, and I try to squeeze them and leave the seed on the tree rather than have to pit them in the house.
Mm-hmm.
And then, so I'm wondering if, number one, is that okay to leave those on the tree? Number two, I've been told that pit stone roots like that have arsenic or cyanide in the stone. And I'm wondering if those pits drop to the ground, is that going to create some kind of a problem?
I don't think so. I mean, the apple trees have, you know, same issue. They're everywhere. It's such a small amount that I don't see how that would cause any problems.
Yeah, and I'm not like a chemist or anything, but I think they get the arsenic from the ground itself. So I don't think that they make it. I think it's probably drawn up from the soil, and then they just drop it back.
Yeah,
so just drop where it came from.
I think you're right. I'm pretty sure you're right on that, Ben. So I wouldn't worry about that, Mike. But what about just leaving the pit attached to the tree?
It'll just fall off.
They'll fall off eventually anyway. Yeah.
It's like if you lift the fruit attached to the tree, it's just going to fall off.
Yeah. Mike, there you go. Thank you so much. Appreciate it. Shirley in Marengo, we'll go to you. Hi, Shirley.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. My concern is that we've had the spongy moth worm infesting our gardens this year, and this year they're really working on the blueberry plants, and they've defoliated just about all the leaves off of them, but there are blueberries. I'm wondering if I'm going to get a crop this year. Is that going to affect the maturity of the blueberries?
So spongy moth is a really bad moth for sure. And I think if your blueberries are getting their foliage taken off of them, that's a bad sign. Mm-hmm. I think you're going to want to do something about that. You know, maybe it doesn't have to be a severe chemical treatment, but maybe a physical removal of those insects would be the best thing for you to do.
Yeah, I think you got to be active with some, you could use some insecticidal soap, or you could use just plain soap. You have to be, and water, soapy water. You have to be a little careful though. If you put too much on, you can damage the leaves as well. But I'd be really, you need to be really active getting after those leaves. I certainly agree with Ben and Carrie on that one, Shirley. Thank you very much. Good luck. I know it's a pain, and if there's a lot of them out there, you're going to be a busy person, but it's going to be hard for those plants to develop without the leaves, that's for sure, and the berries themselves. Eric emailed. He lives in hardiness zone 4B, so he's north of Eagle River. Can you recommend native or non-native plants that attract pollinators? Oh, get this. And are deer resistant? He has lots of deer, and they are not shy.
Yeah, that's the thing. A lot of native plants, and because, again, they evolved with the native deer, so the deer will eat them. So, and some years it's cyclical, like last year with the drought, they were eating stuff I've never seen them eat before. They were eating alliums, you know, nodding pink onions, you know, things that actually are somewhat toxic and don't taste good, but they were just going after anything for moisture. That said, ornamental onion, alliums, great for pollinators and usually tough as nails, and the rabbits and deer most years leave it alone. Also, there's lots of varieties out there that are there's ones that are a little taller, there's ones that are compact, and I'm talking about the alliums that are going to bloom in summer, not the spring ones that go dormant. Let's see, what else?
Yarrow,
that's a good one. There is native yarrow, but a lot of times people don't like it because if it gets in your lawn, you're never getting it out, which for me, I don't mind because it's just like a bee lawn then. But there are like yarrow hybrids out there that are good, and they're also very drought resistant and typically really hardy. Retibidas, tall cone flowers, those they usually leave alone. I mentioned Anna's hyssop. Usually anything in the mint family is pretty deer resistant. So that would be your bee balms, your Monardas. We're going into non-native. I love a calamintha called Montrose White. It has sterile seeds, so it's not going to reseed through your whole yard, nor does it spread by ribosomes. But basically, they're starting to bloom now, and it's just going to be an airy cloud of white until fall, and they get some nice fall color tinge on the leaves, and it's just a magnet for honeybees and bumblebees. One of my favorites. I use it all the time. It likes a lot of sun, and it likes it dry.
A lot of good suggestions there. And, of course, this year, we're not too worried about drought anywhere in the state. Even in the north, we've caught up quite a bit with the amount of precipitation we've had. So, that's a good thing for sure. Dan in Star Prairie, your turn. Hi, Dan.
Thank you so much for taking my call. I have a Christmas tree farm and an apple orchard. My question is brown vetch. It's getting to be so invasive. It strangles plants and ground covers. I've been trying to control it, stay on top of it, spot spray it. I've been using mainly 2,4-D, real careful. It seems to kill it, but it's like it always comes back, and I know the deer chew it and birds must transfer it. Do you guys have any advice on how to control that?
Crown vetch. It's got a pretty good root system.
Are you doing any pre-emergent? Like to try, because I'm sure you've got a ton of seed bed that's coming up too. So even if you're killing the vegetation above the ground, if there's like seed in the soil that's going to be constantly germinating, you probably want to do something like that. Pre-emergent, that would be like, you know, commercially, usually see it as preen. There's, we've got like commercial grade stuff that we use called Snapshot. And then there are organic options too. It's made out of corn gluten. So if you want to go a more organic approach, you can do that. It just requires more applications. Then there's also suppression that it sounds like it's a big area. So I don't think like putting down matting is probably feasible for you.
That right, Dan?
Yeah, I don't have it in large areas. It just like spots up and I'll get like 3-4 plants or 10 or 12 plants. I'll try some pre-emergent. It's a tricky plant. And you see along highways and stuff where it's growing and it just totally smothers everything else out. So.
Yeah, unfortunately. Dan, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Great to have you with us for this edition of Garden Talk. We started by talking about pollinators, and we're continuing that discussion, but certainly taking other questions as well today. The number to call, 800-642-1234. You can email us to talk@wpr.org. Our guests, Carrie Hennessy and Ben French, from Johnson's Nursery in Menominee Falls, here on WPR News for Garden Talk. Thanks for joining us for Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here, and you probably just heard mention of our one-day member drive coming up next week on June 27th. We still need to raise the same amount of money as we do in a regular drive, and in order to do that, we have a special challenge, in effect, to meet our goal. When 500 people donate more than donate before the 27th, so if you can do that before the 27th, we'll receive an additional $10,000 from a group of generous members, which is pretty cool. So you could become one of the first 500, one among the 500. To donate any amount, and you can do it at wpr.org/donate. Easy to do. Larry in Madison will give you a chance. Hi, Larry.
Yes, I was wondering about, I have some hydrangeas, and there are various types, and one for the last 2 years, something has been nipping off the tops of the flowers. It's almost like my barber. It's that precise.
Snipping them right off. My guess is it's deer. Now, are these hydrangeas that are in shade or sun? Not that it really matters, because the deer are probably eating them regardless.
It's pretty sunny, and it's along a driveway. We have about maybe 8-10 hydrangeas, and it's only this one that they've attacked.
So of the 8 or 10 hydrangeas, only one is being eaten?
Yes.
Huh.
The same one every time.
That? You know, deer are creatures of habit, so it could just be that that is close enough to their normal walking trail, and that's where they like to graze, and they're just not adventurous enough to go and eat the other ones. So I guess just be thankful that the other ones are blooming. You can use repellents on it if you want to try to keep them away. There's ones formulated specifically for deer. You know, there's like Liquid Fence, there's Bob X brand. Just, you know, you pick something that's, you know, it's organic, and they usually smell really bad. So you don't want to be downwind when you're spraying. And then the more rain we get, you will have to reapply. But generally, if you spray about once a month, that can help keep the deer away. So you actually get flowers. Also, they can build resistance. So you might have to switch up product brands from year to year that they get used to it. But I guess, you're lucky that they're not eating the other ones. So just look at it that way.
Yeah. Of course, if you then put all that on the one, they might decide to go and visit the one next time.
True. Yeah. So in that case, you could also consider putting up like a chicken wire fence to keep them away, far enough away from the shrubs that they can't reach over and eat them.
Yeah. It's the other way to go, Larry. Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. And, you know, you could always set up a camera.
Oh, yeah.
They're pretty, well, they're reasonably inexpensive ones now out there that you can set up, trail camera, and know for sure. But I think Carrie's right about that. Deer. So there you go. Thank you for calling. Dot in Manitowoc, your turn. Hi, Dot.
Hi. Good morning. I wish the rabbits would like my daisies. They're wild daisies. And I would like to dig them out, naturally, or get rid of them. But now, do I have to dig them out from the root, or if I keep snipping off the stems, will they stop blooming, and could I get rid of them? And also, I have jewelweed, and I'm... Every year I'm after the jewelweed, too, but the rabbits don't seem to like the jewelweed as they do my morning glories.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, rabbits. Because we're having such mild winters, especially this year, I'm noticing rabbit populations, they just did not die off over winter, so there's a lot of them right now. And again, they will eat stuff that they usually don't because of population pressure. There's, you know, they're fighting for food. So your daisies... If you keep cutting them back, eventually those roots will run out of steam. But because the wild ones, like the way they spread, I think the best thing to do is to dig them out. And unfortunately, if you leave a little piece behind, it still might keep regenerating. So you're going to have to keep digging and or use herbicide. Or if you dig them out and want to replant something, put weed barrier around what you're planting so they can't pop through and crowd out the new stuff. I think your other question was about jewelweed, which jewelweed is actually a Wisconsin native, even though we consider it to be a weed. The nice thing about jewelweed is that it's quite easy to pull out of the ground. It has a very shallow rooting system, kind of satisfying to pull them out personally. And it is important for pollinators, you know, but usually people, it's fine in a woodland setting, but like you don't really want it in your yard. So again, you can just hand pull, but you can also, because it's an annual weed, you can use the pre-emergence, like preen, to keep the seeds from re-germinating just to suppress that. It's not going to, you know, the pre-emergence aren't going to kill anything that's already growing. It just keeps that chemical reaction from the seeds happening, so they're not going to pop through every year.
Dot, there you go. Good luck. Thank you so much for calling. Let's go to Catherine in Poinette. Hi, Catherine.
Hi. I have a question about pruning my rose tree. I believe that it's a Ragusa rose, and it's very old. It's been about 5 feet tall since at least 1997 when we bought the property, and it's got stems that are like 3 to 5 feet tall before there's any leaves or roses, and I have no idea how to prune that.
Okay. I'm taking all these questions for a while because Ben had a irrigation troubleshooting emergency. He had to go out to our yard. So I'm flying solo for a bit. I don't know if he'll be back. did you say it's a Ragusa rose? Is that what you said?
Yes.
I think so. I think it is, yes.
Oh, that's fantastic. Because the nice thing about Ragusa roses is that you can cut that all the way to the ground. It will be fine. Usually what I tell people with roses, leave them up over the winter, because if we have a really hard winter, those stems help protect them. But in the spring, even if they all are coming back, I still like to cut them back hard just to keep them uniform and force them to push out fresh growth, especially rugoses, because those older canes, those stems, oh my gosh, they're wicked with the thorns. So at least the newer growth isn't quite as dangerous to touch. But at this point, if are they setting flowers? Are they blooming already or not?
Yes. Oh, yes, they're blooming.
Okay. So when they're done blooming, at this point, I would enjoy the blooms. And then once they're done and they start to go into what we call the rose hip production stage, cut those stems all the way to the ground, and then they will push out new growth. And chances are you might actually get a second flush of blooms later this summer into the fall. And then you can just let those stay up and then let the rose hips form. But rugosa roses are like, they can be really aggressive and get really big and robust. But the good news is they handle pruning very well, and you don't have to be gentle. You don't have to do back to the five leaves. Just cut the thing down like to 6 inches.
Yeah. Catherine, there you go. Sounds like a good plan to me. Thank you for calling. And Robert in Middleton, your turn. Hi, Robert.
Yes, good afternoon. I'm calling in favor of one of my favorite prairie plants. My neighbor and I have about 15 acres of prairie, and I have a lot of little gardens around the house with a lot of prairie plants. And I'm guessing that you're experts can guess what plant I'm talking about, but it's a member of a group of plants, of which there are several species that are native to Wisconsin, but there's one of them that's a favorite of mine because it's like crack cocaine for monarch butterflies. In the fall, it's amazing how they come to that. I've had 7 monarchs on one stalk. I told that once to David, who runs a flower factory down in Stoughton, and he laughed and he said he had once 40 on one plant. Can you guess what it is?
Ben's back. You want to guess?
Is it Liatris ligustylis?
Exactly. Winner, winner, chicken dinner. It's meadow blazing star. And there's a bunch of blazing stars, but for some reason, they sure love the ligustylis, Liatris ligustylis. It's a plant that has a stalk, and it's got a pink top, sort of looks like a pink frilly cattail or something. Beautiful plant, and boy, do they love it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can concur with that. I've probably seen 14 monarchs on one stalk. So,
and Ben even sent us photos last year in our production area. We've got like the hoop houses where, you know, all the plants are growing, and it didn't matter that like the other blazing stars were blooming. They were all going to that particular species.
That's really cool. Robert, thank you. That's a great comment. Appreciate your call very much. By the way, just out of curiosity, how large an operation? You talked about hoop houses. I mean, you're on a few acres there, aren't you?
Yeah. How many? So we both work at our Menominee Falls location, and that's where we primarily have like the perennials and shrub production. And how many acres do we have for that?
So we probably have 10 acres of growing just for our own container operation. We've got 10 acres of re-wholesale where we buy in plants from other companies and from our very own tree farm. And then we have our 600 acres in Jackson, which is about 20 minutes north of Menominee Falls. And that's where we do all of our field harvesting.
600, did you say?
Thereabouts.
Oh man, so lots to work with there at the Johnson Nursery in Menominee Falls. And our guest today, Carrie Hennessy, is the horticulturist and landscape designer, and Ben French is the vice president of propagation and product development, and they're going to be with us right up until 12:30 today here on Garden Talk. I'm Larry Mehler for WPR News. You're listening to Garden Talk. Larry Mailer here for WPR News. And with us from Johnson's Nursery in Menominee Falls are Carrie Hennessy, horticulturist and landscape designer, and Ben French, VP of Propagation and Product Development. So, what gardening questions are on your mind? Give us a call. The number's 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. And callers online, let's go to Margaret in Stevens Point. Hi, Margaret.
Hello.
What can we do for you?
Yes. I have two clematis plants, and one is a Comtesse de Bouchard, and another one is a sport called Barbara Harrington. And both of them have yellow and green leaves. It almost looks like a Green Bay Packer plant. And none of my other clematis do that. And I'm wondering if that's just the idiosyncrasy of that particular strain of clematis or if that's something I need to be concerned about.
You take it, Ben. It's concerning.
Yeah, so clematis is really sensitive to a number of root rot issues. And I think maybe those two clematis might be struggling. Stevens Point has some nice sandy soil. I don't know if you in particular have that. And typically clematis do really well there. But this spring was so wet that maybe you're seeing some kind of root rot that you haven't seen before. And that's leading to discoloration on the leaves.
Yeah. Margaret, does that help?
Yes. Is there anything I need to do or just cross my fingers and hope for the best?
Yeah. I mean, if they've got some leaves on them still, I would send those into the diagnostic lab, and they can probably run a couple tests and determine if it's a virus or something else. And then they might be able to help you a little bit further. But I would just keep them, nice and healthy, keep them fertilized. They like a lot of primping and caring. So clematis are picky. They like lots of care.
Yeah, the UW Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic is the place to send if you want to send them in, Margaret, a specimen. If you go online to the website, it explains the best way to do it. Dan in Marinette, it's your turn. Hi, Dan.
Hi, Larry. Just before the break, I loved the conversation about the Liatris ligustylis because I, too, have a few clumps of those, and it's absolutely thrilling to see all the monarchs come through and perch on those. The question I have is, when is a good time to split those to kind of, propagate some new ones and spread them around? The ones that I've got have been established for about 3 years now and are, good and healthy. And is it just like springtime or when's a good time to split your Liatris?
Technically, you could do it now, but it does put a lot more stress on them. Spring is the easiest time when it's just starting to come up. And you could do it when it's dormant, but I prefer to do it in the spring. But a lot of times on job sites, like we might have to move and divide stuff. And usually if you do that, I suggest cutting them back. So even though if they're in full flower and they're beautiful, cut them back, put them in a vase, just because trying to transplant and divide them now in summer, it's going to take up so much energy trying to support those flowers, and it's not going to root in before winter. So that's what I would recommend.
All right. Good luck, Dan. Thank you for calling. Trish and Nina emailed that she just had an ash tree removed from her south-facing front yard. You mentioned elm trees as relative fast growers. Could you recommend a specific variety?
Yeah, there's a bunch of really good varieties out there that I would recommend. Something like a New Harmony or a Princeton, Accolade, all three of those are really good.
And actually, Nancy had emailed on this. She said Emerald Sunshine Elm. Sounds like a more interesting elm than the others.
Yeah, so we just started growing that one ourselves, and it's got a lot of positive press. It's still really new to us, so we don't know a ton about it yet, but it's out there. They did some trials on it. It looks pretty good.
So it's looking pretty good, the Emerald Sunshine. She also mentioned the Katsura trees. They're not native, but they are very interesting tree, are they beneficial to pollinators or other wildlife? The Katsura tree.
Well, they're not invasive, so I would put that in the pro column.
Yeah, so likely not invasive. I don't believe it offers very much to pollinators. There's no big flower to speak of. And I believe they're wind pollinated, but I'm not 100% sure on that. And I don't think anything eats the leaves. So really all you're getting is shade and structure. You know, birds will roost in them and hang out in them, maybe nest in them. But I think that's really all that tree offers for pollinators and wildlife.
They are beautiful, and they are popular because I think they have so few pest problems. But pests aren't always a bad thing. That, like, you don't want to have a quiet yard. If you have a quiet yard, that's a bad thing.
Yeah. Yeah. Jonathan in Madison, what's on your mind?
Hello.
Hi there.
Hello.
I was calling just to see what their expert advice was on Wisconsin native aquatic plants. So for ponds and potentially aquariums, all right, what's good for a pond?
So we don't really sell any truly aquatic plants. We do sell quite a few like marginal or liminal plants, so plants that can be in water sometimes but not all the time.
That would be like your blue flag iris, Achorus sweet flag.
Arrowroot, things like that.
Yeah. All right, Jonathan, there you go. Thank you very much. You know, water's come up more than once here on the show, and it's, you know, we had a lot of rain. Seems like it's still soaking into the soil, at least in my yard anyway. We still need to worry about watering our plants.
Yes, especially if it's newly planted, because they have not rooted in enough to actually, you know, get those water reserves that are in the soil.
You're going to need to put some more down there.
Yeah. So, and I hesitate to tell somebody how often they should water their new plants. It depends on the plant and the site, but there's always certain plants that, like, if I'm doing an installation, that I'll tell people, these are the indicator plants that tell you if things need water, like hydrangeas. It's right there in the name. They're going to need more water to establish. Typically, Rebecca are very thirsty in the beginning. I'm trying to think what else. Katsuras, yes. They're very thirsty. And we're going to need more water to establish.
So what are you thinking here, like an inch a week, or let's say those new plantings?
Yeah, typically if we're getting an inch of water a week, yes. But then if it's really hot and windy, things will dry out faster. Also, if it's a small pot, like a perennial that you brought home, that's going to need more frequent waterings. Whereas a tree, like say you just installed a 2-inch oak tree, we recommend doing infrequent longer waterings. So you put a slow hose on a trickle so that water can get down to the bottom. So say like a 2-inch tree, you're looking about maybe 15 minutes one side, 15 minutes the other side once a week. So that way it deeply waters. Because if you're just doing superficial waterings every day, that's not going to be enough to get to the bottom of that root ball.
We have more callers here. You can join in, by the way. The number to call, 800-642-1234. Give a call. We'll get you on pretty quickly. Perry and Oconto, it's your turn. Thank you for calling.
Yes. I've been trying to identify a tree that's growing in my driveway. And can you recommend any books at all? It's got like almost like a mint shape type of leaf and alternating branches, and it almost looks like a combination between a bush and a tree, because it has several stalks or whatever coming out of the ground, and it is pretty tall now. It's probably 16 feet tall, but it's also growing along the side of the curbs by the sidewalks.
So it's like, are all of those branches, they're all like 16 feet tall?
Yeah, it almost looks like there's two trees together, actually. They have alternating leaves. The leaves are alternating. They're kind of a mint-shaped or maybe an elm-like structure to them.
The leaf.
Yeah, so that could be like a Siberian elm or an American elm seedling that's popping up in there. You know, I kind of went with mulberry. You know, sometimes they have a mint-looking leaf, mm-hmm. but usually they're lobed as well on other parts of the plant. But I guess as far as like identification books go, you can get real simple ones like a golden guide for trees. You know, you can find those at for like a couple bucks, and they have really good pictures and they identify like the top 100 trees in our area. Or you can go even deeper and you can get like a Peterson field guide. You know, that's a little bit more, I guess, technical because it has like keys in the back where you have to count buds and leaf serrations and find how big the leaf is by the inch, things like that. So those are the two starter books that I would recommend.
Yeah. Is there an app for your phone out there that you guys like?
I constantly have customers using apps, whether it's like Google Lens or, you know, other apps. A lot of times they'll use them in front of me and they say, this is what it says it is. I'm like, that's not what it is. So funny, Ben oftentimes is my app. I'll take pictures and send it to him all the time.
Yeah. So they're not places like apps like Seek, they're not always accurate, but they give you some idea.
Sometimes I will just go into Google Images and I will type in identifying characteristics. Like I do this with caterpillars all the time, and I'll go through Google Images until I find what I'm looking for. I've done that before.
Chris in Albany, it's your turn. Chris, thanks for calling.
Thank you. It's nice to be on. Hi, Carrie.
Hi.
You don't remember me? Yeah. I was listening in the car.
Hi. Yes. I was actually wondering if you might hear me today on here.
Well, Nick called your mother and your mother called me.
All my ringers are
in the car. Yep. My comment was on not buying shrubs and trees from big box stores because they very frequently, their suppliers are from out of state and they're warmer. Mm-hmm. Warmer climate zones, and they have a higher winter kill. So as the grower said, always best to go to somebody you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. And Ben can talk more about this, that we specialize in a lot of local ecotype. You want to talk about that?
Yeah, so that comment matters especially for the native plant category that we're talking about today. To maximize the benefit to all the different species that are going to utilize your plant, whether it's pollinators or wildlife, whatever, you want to get a plant that's adapted to your local ecosystem. And plants are an interstate trade. You want to make sure that if you're buying a swamp white oak, that it's a swamp white oak from your region. And the closer you can get to your region, the better off everything is going to be. The tree is going to be happier, and you're going to support all those wildlife goals that you might have in addition to just having a live tree.
All good points. Chris, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Chris.
we have Luke and Grandin up next. Luke, hello.
Hey, how are you doing?
Good. Appreciate the call.
Yeah. Back in 2018, I grafted some apple scions onto some old trees I had here on the property. I can't remember how many I did. I think six or eight. And the deer got most of them, but two of them made it. And they're growing like crazy. And I get a few blossoms, last year and this year, but I never seem to get any apples. How long does it take for those things to take hold? And the other question is, I got some little seedlings, chestnut seedlings from my granddaughter who lives on the north side of Milwaukee. They got a chestnut tree in their backyard. I planted four of them here around my property. What are the chances those things are going to make it? They do have some orange spots on the leaves and are not very big. Yeah. But I planted them and guarded them well, and they seem to be doing okay so far.
Ben, what do you think?
Well, what I think for your grafted plants is typically they're going to flower and fruit pretty good like the first year or two right after grafting because they still maintain that mature wood history. So they're going to just flower because they already had flower buds set. After that, they're going to realize they're too small and they're going to want to grow rapidly for the next probably 5 to 10 years, you know, maybe a little bit less or more depending on your soil and how that tree was going into the ground, you know, how big it was. And then it's going to start producing apples. You know, once it probably gets maybe something like 8 feet tall, 4 feet wide, something in that range is what I'm imagining. And it varies a lot based on rootstock and variety of apple that you grafted. So probably pretty soon. If it wasn't this year, it might be in the next couple. And as far as your chestnuts go, like those sound like horse chestnuts to me. So plant in the Ascalis group, most likely Ascalis hippocastinum. And that orange spot that you're seeing on the leaf is a natural thing. It's called leaf scorch. It's a bacteria that just always attacks that plant. This is an especially bad year for leaf scorch, and it makes them look a little bit ugly, but they almost always survive that issue.
Yeah. And there are some varieties that are more resistant to it than others. And so if you're growing from seed, who knows, maybe you will have some, well, no, they already have the squirrel, so you don't have one of those. But maybe one of the other seedlings that they collect might be more resistant.
Thanks again for that question. And Val in Wapaka has a question for you. Hi, Val.
Hello, Larry. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm wondering specifically about my apple trees. You're talking about pollinators. And I was wondering, I have some anthills around my yard, around the trees, and I'm wondering if ants are actually good pollinators.
Trying
That's
to think.
That's an interesting question. Because apples require cross-pollination, I'm going to say probably not, because they'd have to go from one tree to another. So unless you have branches that are like, you know, on another separate variety that are like touching that they could cross, not usually. So it's usually the flying insects that are going to pollinate your apples as well as wind.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. Val, there you go. Thank you. Jody emailed. She planted three columnar birch about 7 years ago. They're now 10 feet wide and about 30 feet tall. The trunk is about 8 inches in diameter.
Oh, wow.
For each of the three columnar birch, a tree person came through and said she should chop about 6 to 8 feet off the top, as they will keep getting unusually tall and narrow. Is that necessary? Any advice?
Columnar birch growing that fast?
Yeah.
It sounds like poplar. Columnar poplar to me. Yeah, that was my first instinct as well. I guess if there was truly a tree care company that gave this recommendation, they might know more than me. But it sounds to me like, you know, if height is a concern, then yes, chop them. If height is not a concern in that particular spot, just leave them grow.
Yeah, I think a lot of times people think that they need to be cutting stuff off their trees. And truly, most of the time, you don't need to be. Unless like it's under power lines or something, that it's best to just leave them alone. Unless there's broken branches, or like rubbing across branches, or crowding issues. And keep in mind, if you're topping, you're going to be topping for infinity. That it's going to keep, wherever you make that cut, it's going to keep sending new shoots below it. So it's just going to keep trying to get to that height because that's what it wants to do.
Yeah, and I think it might be a poplar.
Yeah, I don't know any birches that are that vigorous around here.
I don't think I've ever seen them. Someone else emailed, how do you know when to prune hydrangeas, or should you prune them?
It depends on the kind of hydrangea. So generally the ones that have the round balls, those are the ones you can cut to the ground in spring and let regenerate. And even though sometimes that they will have the woody stems survive the winter above ground, I still usually like to cut them back so they don't get too floppy. And the round ones usually are also the more shade tolerant. The ones that you're going to have in the sunnier areas, those are the paniculatas. Those are woodier and they can be cut to the ground. A lot of people will do that, but it just takes a while for them to regenerate. And typically then the wood is weaker and you get the floppiness. So again, my hydrangeas at home, I usually just snip off the tips of, this is the hydrangea paniculata, the sun loving ones. I'll just snip off the flowers from the previous year. And if I do need to control the height, I don't do like a superficial shear, because again, we're going to get that weaked wood spindly look. I will select a stem and actually take it down in the middle of the shrub farther than what I want, so it'll regenerate and get a little stronger.
Yeah, that makes sense. When it comes to landscaping, what kinds of trends have you seen in the last few years?
Well, natives.
Natives.
Yeah. Native plants. Some really small or dwarf plants are really popular.
Ben and I both live in West Dallas, so we have small city lots, and I'm always looking for, you know, things that aren't going to overwhelm my yard. So that's definitely a trend. But pollinators, my goodness, pollinators, bees, you know, the no-mow May has come up. And so a lot of people aren't mowing, even though like they don't necessarily have lawns that support the pollinators. They're participating. But that it at least it has a benefit, and then it gets the word out. So like now even my son at school, he's, you know, was second grade, you know, they're learning about bees and things like that. And so that's definitely probably the trend I'm seeing the most.
Yeah, you know, if you've got Creeping Charlie in your lawn, that's probably a good thing for pollinators.
Creeping Charlie actually doesn't support the bees as much as you think. That you'll see the bees on them, but there's not a lot of nectar in those flowers, so they have to work really hard and visit more of the Creeping Charlie flowers to get what they need than if they were just to go to a native plant, and then it's kind of like a one-stop shop. Like, Creeping Charlie is kind of like going to the mall, and you have to visit a lot of stores to get what you need, whereas you could just go to one-stop shopping. Like,
although, but they're the first ones to flower, practically the first thing to flower. So they're there.
I'd rather have white clover in my lawn for the bees than Creeping Charlie. That's much better.
Well, I think I'd agree with you on that. And it's been a pleasure. Will you guys come back and be with us again? It'd be fun to have you do it.
Absolutely. It was good.
For sure. I love it.
I'll get more of my family to call in. I didn't even tell them I was doing this, so this was just very random.
Well, it's been a lot of fun, and Ben and Carrie, and thank you so much. We'll try and do it again. Appreciate it very much.
Thanks, Larry.
With us from Johnson's Nursery in Menominee Falls, Carrie Hennessy, horticulturist and landscape designer, and also Ben French, the VP of Propagation and Product Development. Have fun having them with us here on Garden Talk. And, you know, coming up in a bit, we're going to be talking about some new vegetable varieties. We're going to be talking about the beets and carrots and onions with our guests. Stay with us. So, do you like to try new vegetable varieties? Up next, we're going to take a look at what's trending with our guest, Erwin Goldman. Good to have him back with us. He's professor, interim senior associate dean in the College of Ag and Life Sciences, and, of course, a professor in the Department of Plant and Agrosystem Sciences at UW-Madison. And his research focuses on vegetable breeding and genetics. He loves beets. And he does a lot of work in that area, but he also he likes carrots and he likes onions too. So he works in those areas as well. So I want to ask him about some of his research in those areas. But what questions do you have about vegetable varieties? Are you looking for one that will do well in your garden? Give us a call. The number's 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234, or you could send us an email to talk@wpr.org. Erwin, good to have you back.
It's so great to be here, Larry. Thank you.
Do you know, I wonder about trends in, you know, we can talk about trends in production, but what about trends in consumption, vegetable consumption?
It's a great question, Larry. You know, I'm seeing a lot of interest in diversifying the type of variety that consumers are interested in. So, for example, I don't know how many decades we all ate orange carrots and we thought that was the only carrot.
Yeah.
But now purple carrots and yellow carrots and even red carrots are easily found and of great interest to consumers. Mm-hmm. Purple broccoli, orange cauliflower. All of these things, I think, represent a trend in visual diversity in the marketplace that consumers are interested in.
I love that, too, because I think it encourages people to eat more vegetables.
Absolutely. I mean, we eat with our eyes.
Yeah.
And because of that, plant breeders have exploited the color variations that are out there. These are natural variations. Mm-hmm. So these aren't genetically engineered in any way. But plant breeders went back to the germplasm and brought in those colors and has really, I think, diversified the marketplace.
I would definitely agree with you on that. And that is a big change. Fred in Menominee has a question for you about germination. Let's
sure.
go there. Hi, Fred.
Well, hi. Say, we've been using Young Seeds for many, many years.
Mm-hmm. It's a great company.
Yeah, and always had good germination. This year, our carrots, our beets, especially the beets, and our squashes, and our corn, they just aren't germinating like they usually do.
Hmm.
I'm an organic gardener, so mm-hmm. I mulch things, et cetera, et cetera. And, the beets, I planted a whole row of beets in a raised bed, so it's only about 6 foot long. But I've got something like 5 beets in that whole row.
Hmm. I would expect that the germination percentage on those seeds you bought is quite high. And I know that the company, I'm sure, stands by the products that they sell. I'm wondering if maybe you have a hard soil, in other words, a hard pan or a hard covering of the soil. Sometimes beets, they just don't push through the crust very well. Is it possible that you have a crust there?
It's sandy soil, mm-hmm. and it started when I moved here 40 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
The garden was basically construction sand.
Hmm.
I mean,
I've
thrown organic stuff in there, so there's nothing hard about it.
Hmm. Okay. Hmm. That's curious. Did you dig down and look at the seed balls and see what they look like?
There was nothing left. So do I have an invasive?
Oh,
that
animal?
Could be.
Yeah, if you couldn't find, so you couldn't find the seed ball at all?
No.
Okay, well then I would suspect that something happened there with the seed. Maybe it got washed away or in a storm or an animal
eaten
dug
by
it up.
Something.
Yeah, because your soil, they should push right through that. And germination, usually, most of that seed should germinate at least 80%, 85%. So I'm wondering if perhaps, did you notice if the seeds were gone with some of your other crops, like your carrots?
The carrots germinated nicely.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm. Have you still got some of those seeds left?
Oh, yeah.
You might put some in some little pots.
Yep. Take a paper towel or two, wet it, put the seeds in the paper towel and just keep it close to moisture, maybe in a cup, and see how they germinate.
Yeah, put 10 seeds in there and 8 of them ought to germinate,
mm-hmm.
At least, I would think. I'd try that. And of course, as you say, Young's is going to honor, if there was something wrong, they would certainly replace seeds.
That would be my guess.
Thanks, Fred. Chuck in West Salem. Hi, Chuck.
Hi. This year I experimented with buying something called honey sugar snap peas.
Mm-hmm.
And the major difference I'm told is that it's going to have yellow pods instead of green. but I was wondering if there are other characteristics of it that I'm unaware of. Are they, so far I've seen blooms, but I haven't seen any pods yet. Should I anticipate that they'll be sweeter, or are they as productive? Do you have any experience with honey sugar snaps?
I don't know the variety, but the name suggests to me that they are, so you know, marketed for sweetness, and that's, you know, definitely one of the major trends that I'm seeing is the sort of diversification of flavor and sweetness and sugar in the marketplace. But I don't know the variety myself. Larry, do you know it?
No, I don't.
So I wish you all the best with it, but it sounds, hopefully it'll be tasty.
Good luck, Chuck. Thank you. Madison, who is in the vehicle, I believe. Madison, hi.
Hi there. Yes, I'm just passing through. I enjoy your show. Thanks for educating.
Oh, thanks for joining in. What's on your mind?
Well, I was actually, I'm looking to start like growing a little bit of a garden just in some plant beds on my deck. And I was wondering what I could start growing at this time of year.
Well, you can really produce a lot even now. We're still early enough in the season. You can grow all the way into October without any trouble. So I would suggest that all of the, you know, many of the crops that you'd be interested in, probably you could grow beans, you could grow peas, you can still plant carrots, although we're kind of getting towards the end of the time when you'd want to plant carrots. But you could plant spinach, you could plant, you know, different kinds of greens. I think it's probably a little late for big squash like pumpkins, but you could probably produce many of the vegetables that you'd be interested in. Are there particular crops that you'd like to see?
Well, I just am trying to diversify my palate now, and I'm just wondering how to start gardening, like, as a beginner. So, the easiest things to grow together as well.
Well, greens are always a good thing to grow. I mean, the lettuces don't like the hot weather. You might want to wait a little bit and grow those into the fall. But greens, you might have a crop within 30 days. And so you can grow radishes. You can grow some short season crops and give yourself a little experience. That might be a nice thing to try. If you can get a hold of some transplants, you might be able to put tomatoes and peppers in your beds as well. And that may still do well for you this year.
Yeah. I was thinking about peppers. I mean, usually I wait later anyway for peppers because... If they got hit with a cold spot or something, you'll get great plants, but no peppers.
Right.
So, yeah, you'd be in the market. Madison, you got lots of opportunities there. If you go to the UW, I'm trying to think of the, what's coming to mind, bulletins. The University of Wisconsin-Madison Gardening Bulletins. Type that in.
Yeah, there's one on vegetable production.
There's one on vegetable production. Mm-hmm. The Learning Store, UW Learning Store. You're going to find out a whole bunch of tips right there. Mm-hmm. And stay listening to Garden Talk. We do it every Friday. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Let's see. Neva emailed that she has a lot of container plants. She heard she could start corn. When it does take off, then start bean to climb the stalks, then start squash. Does that sound correct?
That's the three sisters, and that is that certainly predates our European-style agriculture. That's an indigenous production system that has been going for 10,000 years or more, and it's a beautiful way to go. I think the use of the corn stalk to support the beans makes sense, and then, of course, I wasn't thinking of in containers. In a field, the squash will do some weed suppression because they spread out. In containers, I think it's going to be a little more difficult because of the way the squash sort of trails out. But nevertheless, with one of our classes in the spring semester, we did grow the three sisters in containers, and it does work very well. So I absolutely think that's going to work very well for her.
Matthew and Amberg, it's your turn. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. This actually, the last thing you were just speaking about really relates to what I'm doing. I'm doing the Three Sisters, and in with the beans, I've been mixing in what they call the Oregon Giant sugar snap peas, thinking that, you know, it's a legume, so maybe it'll still work. I had never heard of them before. The description sounded interesting, so I thought I would try them. I was just wondering if you're familiar with those and if you have any sort of advice as far as taking good care of them.
I mean, I've seen grown sugar snap peas and seen different kinds of them, and that absolutely makes sense in that kind of production system. I mean, you're not, instead of growing a dry bean, you're going to be growing something that you're going to eat when it's young and it's tender. You're just going to have to get in and pick those, but they're going to grow very well in that system. So I don't think there's any problem.
Yeah, I think you're good to go, Matthew. Thank you for calling. You can join in, too. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Talk at WPR.org. That's how you can email us. I'm Larry Mueller with Erwin Goldman, professor and interim senior associate dean in the College of Ag and Life Sciences and the Department of Plant and Agrosystem Sciences. Did I get that right?
It's Plant and Agro Ecosystem Sciences. I think you were probably right on, Larry. And that's the bringing together of two longtime traditional departments, yeah. Agronomy and horticulture.
Yeah, right here on WPR News. Great to have you along for Garden Talk. Larry Mueller with my guest, Erwin Goldman, professor in the Department of Plant and Agroecosystem Sciences at UW-Madison. Great to have him with us today. Don in Oshkosh has a question for you. Erwin, let's go there. Hi, Don.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I am calling because I have a cabin in Jackson County, and when I go over there, Babcock, Wisconsin, which is a very small town, has a little stand where a woman sells, it's called honey-dipped sweet corn. And it's fresh, it's crispy, it's sweet, and I can't find it anywhere else, like near Oshkosh where I live. And I'm wondering if you've ever heard of the honey-dipped sweet corn.
Hmm. I don't know the variety, but we can do a little checking to see what we can find out. Larry, do you know the variety?
I don't know the variety. Okay. That's a brand new one to me, and it may be some new kind of marketing name for another one, but we can check on
that.
We'll
do a little checking. Haven't heard of it, but it sounds terrific.
Yeah, it does. And we'll see what we can come up with, but I want to talk a little bit about your work and your research. You know, your lab focuses on genetics of beets, carrots, and onions. And by the way, why those three?
Yeah.
I know you love beets. But
well, you know, those three crops have been historically important to the state of Wisconsin. Beets and carrots, of course, are canning crops, processing crops. So they get typically put in jars and cans or frozen product. And onions have always been a mainstay of the vegetable production of the state. And so my predecessor started working on those in the 1940s when he came to the university. And his goal was to turn those three crops into hybrid varieties. And there were hybrids in corn at the time, but there weren't hybrids in many of the vegetables. And so during his 40-year career, he did that. And I continued that work for the last 32 years. And we're breeding those crops to make higher performing varieties for farmers and consumers.
So it's pretty cool. I guess one that I wanted to focus on a little bit was the Badger Flame beet.
Yeah.
How's that? I mean, that kind of created a huge amount of interest. That is a beautiful beet.
Well, thank you, Larry. We've been so pleased to see the reaction to it. And just going back in time, this goes back about 25 years or so, we wanted to diversify the varieties that were available to consumers because, as you know, the beets taste like dirt. They taste like soil. And it's one of the things actually I like about beets is the earthiness of them.
The geosmin,
the earth scent. And beets and spinach to some degree, chard, they all have a little earthiness to them. But when I would go around the state asking people about what they liked, many people would say, it just tastes like dirt to me. I just don't want it. So we spent a lot of time breeding. Nick Breitbach, I want to give Nick credit for this because he was my colleague. We worked on this for many years, selecting away from the earthiness. And Badger Flame and some of its cousins are beet varieties that have low earthiness, and you can taste the sugar. Beets are full of sucrose, and it's just sometimes hard to taste the sweetness when you're getting that hit of earthiness. So the Badger Flame has been a nice... people have had a nice response to it because you can eat it fresh. You can eat it like you eat a carrot. You can just peel it and taste it raw, and you get that, you get a little hint of the earthiness, but mostly sweetness.
Yeah, and is it readily available? I mean, seeds and so forth?
So seeds are available from at least three companies now that are selling them across the country, and they show up in grocery stores, although in Wisconsin it's been hit or miss. But on the East Coast, in Boston, they've been showing up. They've been showing up at Wegmans Grocery, and which is in the Northeast. And I think with each year, more stores are carrying them as they catch on. It just takes time for people, by word of mouth to get around.
That whole business about the earthiness and so, if you take beets and grill them,
mm-hmm.
which we've talked about I think on the show before,
yeah.
they taste so good.
Right. You get all that sugar coming out and you can taste the sweetness, right?
The Mad Dog and Merrill, the grilling buddies, did some grilling at my house once. We had a group of people there and we had all these vegetables that they grilled, and there were beets in there. And this is when I first learned of this, and Mad Dog said, I'll bet you the beets go first. Well, they didn't go first, but once people tried one or two,
yep.
all the beets were gone.
Absolutely. they're like little they're wonderful and they're beautiful. You know, they're mm-hmm. they have that great red color and they're tasty. Yeah, so I think the sugar that's present is a real plus, but sometimes people just get turned off by the other things that are present in there, so you got to get rid of them.
Sherry in Oshkosh has something about, or a question about beets, I think. Hi, Sherry.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. So, first of all, thanks for taking my call. I love this show, all the iterations of it.
Thank you.
I have a problem with kidney stones, and so... that's caused by oxalic acid.
Yes.
And I've been told that I cannot eat my two favorite vegetables with frequency. And I actually don't eat them at all because I'm not taking any chances. But they include beets and sweet potatoes.
Right.
The spinach I can do without. Mm-hmm. Is there any chance that they could be bred to not have... Yes,
that is such an excellent question. And in fact, for years, since 2013 or 2014, I've been involved in exactly that type of project. Now, the challenge to that, now, just for the listeners, for clarity, oxalic acid is a naturally occurring compound in plants, and it is a defense. The plants use it to defend themselves. So as you select away from oxalates in the plant, you can reduce their levels, but you can also make a plant that has a hard time defending itself. So that's the challenge there. And people all over the world have been thinking about and trying to do that. I do think we'll eventually succeed with it, but it is a delicate matter because of the sort of natural need for the plant to have these oxalates. So one of the things we've been trying to do is just to create low oxalate versions or select low oxalate types. And that's where we're at right now.
Oh, there you go, Sherry. Thank you very much for calling. Mike in Verona, your turn. Hi, Mike.
Hey, how you doing? I had a question about growing buckwheat.
Okay.
And my question is, I'm using it as a cover crop to, I expanded my garden, and it says to, once it flowers, then chop it all down. But I'm wondering, if I'm not using the area, can I just let it reseed itself?
I don't see why not. I mean, I have to say that I don't. This is, I consider the vegetables to be my main domain, but I don't see why not. We do have some cover crop experts though on campus who will probably be able to better answer that question. But my sense is that probably it could reseed itself.
Yeah, and then you might have trouble getting rid of it down the road.
That's right.
That's the only other thing to consider. Because it'll throw a lot of, I mean, you'll have a lot of buckwheat seed.
Yep.
That's for sure, Mike. Norm in Wausau, your turn. Hi, Norm.
Hi. I got to ask your guest, why is it that this year my muskmelon and watermelon plants that I was growing in containers and I hardened them off appropriately and put them out and they seem to be, most of them are dying. It's almost like you sprayed them with Roundup.
Yeah.
And the squashes, though, are doing fine. They're doing great. But
not the melons.
I don't know the answer to that, but I have seen the same. We've seen transplants like that that are just sitting or look like they're shrinking compared to the size they were when they were transplanted. Has the area had a lot of water, a lot of moisture since they've been transplanted?
It has. Unfortunately, that's probably the major issue, although we're up on a granite hill, so the water doesn't set there, but the soil is really saturated.
Yeah.
Because we've gotten so much rain, and then we had some periods where the temperatures dropped down to 40 or below, and that, you know, in the fall, I know that sometimes we'll just kill them off like you sprayed them.
Right.
Yeah.
I suspect that you already know the reasons, and so hopefully it'll be a little drier and a little warmer for you going forward. I don't lose hope. Keep taking care of them.
Yeah, for sure. Really appreciate your call, Norm. Thank you so much. What about your research? What are you doing with onions and with carrots a bit more?
Yeah, so with carrots, we are also trying to diversify the varieties that are available. We're working on trying to develop different shapes of carrot. And that's been a big part of our project. So we have a carrot. We have a carrot that's you could hold in your hand. It almost is a V shape or a wedge shape kind of a carrot.
Ah.
So, you know, we're used to eating the baby carrots. And those, of course, are cut from a bigger carrot.
Right.
So, and then we have long, thin carrots that we're used to buying in cello type bags. This is a carrot that's more of a... it's kind of a nice size, maybe the size of a sweet potato, kind of chunky. That's one of the projects. Another project is to make different colors, make the reds. And we have some carrots that are purple on the outside and orange on the inside. So that's a big, you know, that's a thing we're doing as well.
I love that. And onions?
Onions the same. I've been very interested in the flat cipollini type onion, you know, the really nice, beautiful flats. So I have been trying to breed different shapes of that. And then a big part of our onion program has focused on early maturity. So we want onions that will go down, tops down as quickly as possible to create something that you could harvest early in the season when some of the other early vegetables are ready.
That is great. And you have a lot of grad students and people working with you.
We do. We have a great group. We have 5 graduate students, 2 postdocs, a bunch of undergraduates. They're out in the field at Hancock right now, thinning beets while I'm here. But yeah, that is the most I love creating new varieties of vegetables, but probably the best thing that we produce in our program is the trained people that go out and do great things in the world. And it's the most rewarding thing to work with these bright, bright students.
Always a pleasure, Irwin. Thank you so much for spending time with us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, Larry.
Irwin Goldman, professor and interim associate dean in the College of Ag and Life Sciences. His department is the Department of Plant and Agroecosystem Sciences at UW. And we will have him back. And we'll do this again. It was a lot of fun. Lots of people are involved in this program. It's a team effort. Our producers, Clara Neipert, Joel Patnaud, our technical directors, are Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins, executive directors, Jill Nadeau, and I'm Larry Mueller. Thank you for listening to Garden Talk. Stay with us. Lots more in store.